Podcasting softly, listeners. I am going to struggle a little bit this morning because I'm very nervous. I'm uncharacteristically nervous because my guest today had a hand in bringing to all of us, all of children of a certain generation, a film that not only changed the course of cinema history, but changed all of our lives and led us on our own creative paths, looking to find our own galaxies far, far away. He's here to talk about a wonderful book that he has written about his life career in the movie business in a cutting room far, far away. I am very humbled, very honored, very privileged to welcome Academy Award winner and the editor of Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back and many, many other films that we'll talk about over the course of this interview, Mr. Paul Hirsch. Welcome to Podcasting Them Softly.
Thank you. I feel honored and privileged myself.
You're very kind. It is a wonderful book, sir. Now, the
thank you.
I've listened to some other interviews that you've done, which I always do prior to interviewing somebody. Instead of just going the old sort of mixed bag of probably stock standard questions, I've gone through your book and read it a couple of times, and I've jotted down a few things as I went through, and I thought I might just mention it, and you can comment, and we'll muse on a few of these things that I sort of. It's a wonderful story. It might make a good movie, I think.
Yeah.
A long time ago in a cutting room far, far away. So the first little thing I wrote down, Paul, was that's what editing can do.
Yes.
Which comes from when you were talking about the substitution of a shot from Obsession, Brian De Palma's Obsession.
Yes.
That's what editing can do. And I really believe that. I mean, an editor can really affect the course of a film. You write several times about subtle manipulations that really made sequences, both in films that you have watched that you haven't personally edited, films that you watch, films that you like, but also films that you've worked on.
Yeah. One of the things I say in the book is that context is everything.
Yes.
In the case of Obsession, we had a situation where there's an event that took place in the film. I don't want to give any spoilers away, but there was an event that takes place in the film that studios found objectionable. And this was an independent production, and the producer was trying to sell it for distribution to a studio, and all the studios in Hollywood turned the picture down, and we were stuck, and I was thinking about it, and I sort of thought, well, what if this event that took place never happened? And I thought, well, we can't cut it out. That won't work. We can't just cut it out. And then it occurred to me that by changing the context, we could change the meaning. In other words, this event was set up with an establishing shot of a house where the event took place. So we had a shot of our lead actor, Cliff Robertson, asleep.
Right.
And I thought, well, what if we take out the shot of the house and we put in the shot of Cliff asleep? Now, the events that take place are framed by, we made it into a dream sequence by putting him sleeping ahead of the sequence.
Right.
So even though we used the exact same footage, we're now saying this never happened, it was only a dream.
Right.
That made the difference, and Columbia picked that up and distributed the film.
And the rest, they say, is Hollywood history.
another
thing I noted down, the biggest hit and the biggest flop.
Yeah.
You know, they seem to have, there's a great line towards the end of your book that I was going to sort of end the interview with, but it's more relevant now, so I'm just going to edit that and move this scene up. The biggest hit, the biggest flop, they all have the common factor that people, I think, always overlook is that near the end of your book, no one sets out to make a bad movie.
Right.
And so the biggest hit and the biggest flop have the same amount of passion, and everyone works hard.
The effort is the same.
Yeah.
In fact, you probably work harder on the ones that don't work.
Probably, yeah. And you mentioned this a couple of times in your book, too. Isn't it funny how there's a few that you've worked on, too, that were underappreciated in their time but have become either cult hit or eventual favorite, like Blowout, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. When they came out, they were not popular for whatever reason. People just didn't go. Over time, they have seen in high regard.
Well, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles did do decent business. It just didn't win the weekends. You know,
yeah,
when there
yeah.
was...
Didn't win the
Three
weekend.
Men Maybe took the weekend, but
right.
Blowout was an absolute failure when it first came out.
Right.
I mean, I saw it in the Hamptons near New York, and people were booing at the end of the movie.
Right.
So it was not an audience pleaser.
No.
At the time.
at the time. But like you said, it's since gone on to become more widely lauded. When I talked to Nancy Allen, the wonderful Nancy Allen, who I had on at the beginning of this year, I said of her, like, everyone wanted me to ask RoboCop questions because RoboCop was kind of the relevant thing until they decided to can it yet again. But pardon the pun. Nancy, I said, you know, two of my favorite performances of hers was in Blowout and Philadelphia Experiment. So it was great to talk to her about Blowout. I like the passage where you talk about music, how you have an affinity. It's part of your craftsmanship is feeling the tempo of music, controlling the pace of a movie.
Yeah, there's a connection between, of all the arts, I think there's a very strong connection between music and film, because the other arts don't involve time terribly much. You know, painting, you can stare out for 4 hours or glance at it for a second. You know, sculpture or a building, you know, architecture. These are not time related. They're more about space than time. There's rhythm in poetry, but the pace at which you read is not set by the artist, and it's only in music and film that the artist is dictating not only the sequence of the details that he presents to the audience, but also the pace, the rate at which these details come to you.
Right.
So there's a very intimate connection between the two. I used to say that I learned more about pacing from Beethoven than I did from any filmmaker.
Right.
There are rhythms inherent in the world, if you look at it that way, and the stressed syllables in speech are equivalent to the downbeats in music, and the unstressed syllables are like the upbeats.
Right.
And any action has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and the time it takes to elapse between the beginning and the middle and the end sets a tempo. It could be a very quick action or a very long action. So there's rhythms constantly in speech and in action, and this is what editors are dealing with, is speech and action, to a large extent. So it's a very close relationship between the two.
What was funny, what made me think of it again and made me write it down, was I was watching Sidney Lumet's great movie, Running on Empty. There's the sequence when River Phoenix first gets into the music class, and the music teacher plays two types of music. He plays pop, disco-y type, you know, 80s.
Yeah.
Funky disco music, and then he plays, I think it was Beethoven. I can't remember. It was Bach or Beethoven. One of them. Classical music. River Phoenix's response was, "Well, you can't dance to Beethoven." You know what I mean? Or you can't dance to Bach.
I don't know that. I think Beethoven's Ninth makes me want to get up and dance.
Really?
But
I personally think that the greatest films, you can listen to the score and see the images, and you can see the images without music and hear the score in your head. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, well, you know, for people of my generation, the only way to enjoy a movie after you'd seen it was to listen to the score. We didn't have DVDs or, you know,
even
videotapes of favorite films. We'd go see it and we'd buy the album, play it at home and reimagine it in our minds. You know, I listened to the score to Spartacus I don't know how many times. It's very evocative, and it's the you know, Bernard Herrmann, the great composer that I had the great good fortune to work with on two pictures.
Yes.
Say that the music in a film provides the emotional connection between the events on the screen and the audience. And you know, I get irritated when I read a critic saying, "Well, the music was telling me how to feel," you know, and I thought, well, music is a legitimate tool of the filmmaker, and without the music, maybe maybe the music wouldn't be telling you how to feel, but you wouldn't feel anything, perhaps. You know, so I'd rather have a great score than this kind of ideological objection to music telling you how to feel. You think about the great films that have lived, you know, long lives. So many of them have unforgettable scores,
true,
like Jaws and Star Wars and
Lawrence of Arabia
and the Bond films, all of Fellini's films, and just no end to the films that have been defined and stay in our memory because of the musical scores.
I'm a big fan of Milkos Rosa myself. You know,
uh-huh.
he did all.
Just, I'm just listening to his violin concerto.
That's fantastic. Herman's line, Brian, where they were talking about, you know, when does the first murder come in the movie? And he says, after half an hour. And he's like, well, Hitchcock did it. And Benny is, for Hitchcock, yeah, they'll wait half an hour, but not for you.
He insisted we had to have a main title.
Yeah.
And the main title prepares the audience psychologically for the experience they're going to have.
Was that something in your friendship with Brian De Palma, was the love of Hitchcock one of the first things you noticed about one of them? Because you both seem to have this great, just from reading your book and then from watching the wonderful documentary about Brian, you both seem to have this great passion for Hitchcock.
Well, frankly, I was just looking for work, you know?
Okay.
I mean, I wouldn't work for anyone, you know, but I had the great good fortune of meeting Brian.
Right, right.
The thing about Hitchcock was that he was, I just read this the other day, maybe it was Scorsese who said it, he was talking about some of these directors were like their own franchise. You'd go see a Hitchcock movie because you knew that his previous films had been so great, so it wasn't like the same story like a franchise is, but or the same characters, but you knew that because it was Hitchcock, it was going to be good.
Right, sure.
He relied very much on visual storytelling and the use of the point of view. And these are techniques that Brian picked up and adopted and improved on in many ways, I'd say. He and Hitchcock were similar. I mean, it's true that Brian was deeply inspired by him, but he was also, just by nature, similar to him. He was sort of, he had this dark sense of humor, and they both had this dark sense of humor. And yeah, it was really a thrill for us to meet. We were very young. I was 26, and Brian was 31, I think, when we met Benny. And to meet this guy who had collaborated with Hitch on so many pictures, and Orson Welles, I mean, it was just an absolute thrill. Just to meet him.
I can only imagine. And later a bit about ending up in Kubrick.
Yeah, he was finishing up The Shining when we arrived to shoot The Empire Strikes Back at Elstree Studios in outside London. And I had bumped into his editor on the lot who invited me to come see Kubrick's setup. He had the first video editing setup that I'd ever heard of, and I was curious to see it. And every time I called, I was sort of, well, today's not a good day, you know. I try next week, and it went on and on like this for many weeks, and I figured I'd never get in there. And then George Lucas came to visit, and he stuck his head in my room. He says, I'm going over to Kubrick's editing room. Want to come with me? And I said, yeah, you know. So so we went over there.
I like how you put in that passage, it took George's clout to get me into Kubrick's editing.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't going to bother with me, you know. So, yeah, but yeah. Kubrick is Kubrick. Stanley's not going to bother with some technician on the picture. What does he care?
Yeah. Paul, in reading this bit, I want to go over it with you just to hear if I understood it right from the book.
Okay.
You talk about in one particular section that George had the initial idea that Luke's lightsaber was going to be red and Vader's was going to be blue.
Well, not exactly. He said, I'm thinking of coloring the lightsabers. I was going to make them blue and red.
Right.
So I said, well, if you're going to do that, then you should really make, you know, in traditional Christian iconography and painting,
yes,
the blue is connected with the celestial and the red is connected with the earthly.
Right.
So if you're going to make them red and blue, I would give blue to Luke and red to Vader.
Right. So in so many words, a little bit of Star Wars history as we know it, because the good guys have blue ones and the bad guys have red ones.
Well, later on, people had green ones, you know, so that sort of...
I know, but just for the initial, some
dropped away, you know. But
yeah, I know, but just for the initial, really, you're pretty much responsible for that.
Well, I made a suggestion. You know, I make all sorts of suggestions. I mean, editors are the suggestion business. That's what we do.
But I mean, obviously, he took your suggestion and ran with it.
Yeah, he took a lot of my suggestions.
I know,
you know, but
and they turned out pretty good, didn't they?
It worked out.
Why not? A bad cut only hurts for a fraction of a second.
Yes.
Right?
That's one of his principles that, you know, George had been to film school, and he was very analytical, and I had not been to film school, and I was sort of learning by the seat of my pants, and my approach to learning film editing was to sort of like the students that you see in museums, sit there copying the old masters.
Yes.
And that was sort of my approach. I'd see something at the movies, and then I would try to do something like it when I got my hands on dailies. I'd say, well, how do I make this look like a movie? You know. So that was my challenge. I had to sort of teach myself how to edit, which actually was very exciting because it felt to me like I was inventing editing, even though I was following a path that had been well trod before me. But for me, for the personal experience of it, it felt very much like I was inventing it. So that was very exciting. Walter Murch told me he had the same experience.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, you think about, you know, to know what it was like before Star Wars, you had to grow up before Star Wars. To know what it was like before there were film schools and guys went to these studios and learnt their trade from the ground up, and their film school was actually making film. I mean, that still continues on in really the best sense, because let's face it, there's lots of kids who can't afford to go to film schools, because film schools are now, you know, these great temples that they were not back in your time. But
they were there, they just weren't on my particular radar. I mean,
right.
When I went to college, when you graduated, it was either medical school or law school, and if you were a jock, you went to business school.
Right.
And then there was architecture school, which I attended briefly.
Right.
And people went to journalism. But film school was sort of off my radar. It never even occurred to me that you could study film.
Right.
And I got into the business, you know, in a different way, which is in my book. You know, there are many ways to get to where you want to go.
That's true. You just need to knock on all the doors. And if they don't open the doors, you go in through the back window. The most ironic quote I think I've read that is probably more relevant today than when he said it. You write in here that George Lucas says this is basically a Disney movie.
Yeah.
Irony, right?
Yeah, in retrospect, sure.
I mean, because let's face it, we're getting a Disney Star Wars at the end of the year. What do you think of the new Star Wars pictures?
What he meant by that was that Disney's approach to showing films,
sure,
but, you know, their intellectual property consisted mostly of the great animated films, you know.
True.
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Sleeping Beauty, Pinocchio, Dumbo, and so forth. And what they would do was they would bring one of these pictures out every 7 years. The idea being that, you know, they would catch a crop of children and then put it away for 7 years, and then 7 years later, they bring it out again, they get in a whole new crop of children to see the same movie.
Sure.
So that was what George intended with Star Wars. He wanted to put it out. He said to me, this will never be on television.
Right.
I will never allow this to be on television.
Right.
They wanted to come out every 7 years and catch a new crop of children, because we thought we were making a movie for kids.
Right.
But we didn't realize we were making a movie that would touch the kid and everyone, you know.
That's
so
true. Timeless, ageless, all that sort of thing.
Well, his plans changed when the results were, you know, different than he expected.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of people that had their money on it back then. If it was,
Spielberg saw the cut of the film and went out and bought Disney, 20th Century Fox stock.
Oh, okay.
So he knew.
This other quote I really liked, which is again ironical considering history. What I'd really like to do is mat him out and replace him with some kind of alien.
Yeah. I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. I just thought, don't like the actor, just put in a creature instead. You know, it just struck me very funny. And then, of course, that's exactly what he did.
Yeah. Another great quote I think that I wrote down of yours was when you were told something by Francis Coppola, and your response was, it will either be an editor's dream or an editor's nightmare.
Right. He was describing to me that he had brought Jerry Greenberg, who was the first New York editor ever to win an Oscar for The French Connection. He had brought him to San Francisco, and he was going to give him, I forget how many 100,000 feet of film. I think I said 100,000 in the book, but somebody told me it was more than that. And tell him that for the next 6 months, all he had to do was cut the greatest 6-minute helicopter battle anyone had ever seen.
Right.
And he said, wouldn't that be great? And I thought it was appalling, because I thought, here's a guy who was a giant in my eyes, and he was given responsibility for only 6 minutes of the film. I mean, I thought it was insulting.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find words. I didn't say anything for the longest time. It was extremely awkward. And I finally, you know, said, I guess it's either a dream or a nightmare. He said, yeah, depending on your attitude, I think.
Next quote, what else did I write down here? Commercial success is accidental.
Yes. That was embroidered on a pillow at Herbert Ross's house. Herbert was a very prominent director, the go-to studio director for some of the biggest films with the biggest stars in the 70s, late 60s and throughout the 70s and early 80s. And this struck me because, you know, as you pointed out earlier, nobody sets out to make a bad movie, but there are a lot of pitfalls, you know.
Yes.
So you do the best you can, and you hope that the audience appreciates it. But it's like I also compared it to making surfboards, you know.
Right.
You make the best board you can. You try to go out there and catch a wave, and sometimes you don't catch the wave, and sometimes you catch a huge one. You know? So there's an element of chance to it.
Speaking about Spielberg, as you did before, rushing out and buying stock because he knew something everyone else didn't, I like what you wrote about when Gary Kurtz came in offering Star Wars merchandise, and you said, I want one of everything.
Yeah, well, I didn't know what I was asking for. I didn't realize what was going to happen. Of course, these boxes came every 6 months, a huge box filled with all sorts of toys, and my kids tore them open and played with them. And, you know, so I suppose if I'd locked them up in a closet, I could, you know, sell them for a lot of money, but we didn't do that.
Oh, well, that's what toys are meant for, isn't it, though? Playing with toys.
Yeah.
Compared to this, we were playing with model planes on strings.
Right, George Lucas said that to me when we saw episode 7, I guess it is.
Right, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the technology has advanced so much. It's extraordinary what they can do now. But there's a danger, you know, that when you do everything through the computer, it becomes kind of lifeless.
Right, right.
And I think that's what Scorsese was complaining about in this recent brouhaha.
Right, right. Marvel movies.
Marvel pictures.
Yeah.
But there's a way you can make stuff so airtight that it loses life.
Right. But yeah, it's funny, like watching the documentaries of the makings of these new Star Wars movies in a time where there is everything that is digital. The filmmakers like J.J. Abrams and Rian Johnson, and of course J.J. is doing The Rise of Skywalker, they seem to be very particular, though, about using as much practicality as possible. I mean, they're shooting on film instead of digital. There's a lot of, they're still building a lot of animatronic aliens and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the technology has hurt the experience. You know, when they made Bond films, you know, and Bond was thrown out of an airplane at 10,000 feet or whatever, they actually, you know, some guy actually jumped out of a plane. Now, it wasn't Roger Moore or whoever was playing Bond at the time. It was a stunt guy. But it was a real person.
Yes.
But now, you know, with digital effects, you can have a truck fly, you know, an inch from somebody's head, and you just shrug because you know it wasn't real, you know. It was just some guy sitting at a computer who did it. So the thrill is gone, to coin a phrase. And this whole streaming thing is very disturbing because, you know, the movies were, to me, exciting partly because they were an event. You know, you had to wait. Audiences had to wait 3 years between the first two Star Wars films and another 3 years to get to, The Return of the Jedi. So that anticipation made the desire to see the picture enormous. And when you take that kind of event experience and you transform it into a steady stream that's always there, like electricity or the water, you just turn on a tap and you can get whatever you want, it robs the experience of that feeling of an event. And I think it's very damaging, and I'm very unhappy about it, to tell you the truth.
I like the idea of sitting down and watching aliens with Kirshner, and especially the bit where you wrote here, it says they were vaginas.
Kirshner saw everything through a sexual lens. That was,
right.
He was a big teenager at heart.
Yeah, I just love the fact of, you know, just picturing him in my mind as I can and hearing that voice and him turning to you and go, did you see that? There were vaginas.
Yeah.
That was fantastic. That's a great bit. You also wrote a nice little passage about Kelvin Pike.
Yes. He told me a great story about how he had worked on a picture called The Devils with Ken Russell.
Right.
And I don't know if you've seen it. It's an extraordinary, crazy movie.
Yeah, I love Ken Russell stuff. He's off the wall.
So in the opening shot, one of the opening sequences, it's in the Middle Ages during the time of the plague, and there are carts in the street filled with dead bodies, and there are pyres in the street where they're burning these bodies, and, you know, there's pestilence and plague everywhere, and there's this tracking shot that they were shooting of, you know, the actor walking through the street and walking past these bonfires, and all of a sudden Kevin is you know, on the dolly, and they're moving backwards, and all of a sudden there's an explosion. He gets blown off the dolly, and it was Russell who had just grabbed a can of gasoline and thrown her on the fire just as they came by. So he was kind of a madman, Kelvin. He was a good man, Kelvin. I hope he's still alive.
I'm not sure. I might have to research that. But
he was a good guy.
How can I cut a trailer without film?
Right.
Yeah.
Gary Kurtz came to me and he said, we're going to need a trailer for Empire Strikes Back. And I said, well, we just started shooting it. I have hardly any film. He said, well, just think about it. You know?
Yeah. What was it like meeting Jim Henson?
That was a thrill. But, I mean, it was just very brief.
I know, but still, I mean, that's...
Gosh, he was so... you know, when I worked with Baz Luhrmann,
yeah.
he said, the most we can hope for in our careers in film is to work on something that changes the culture. And it becomes, not changes, but that becomes part of the culture. And Henson certainly had done that. I mean, he was such a powerful and original voice that suddenly appeared, and you know, the Muppets came along, and it was as if he'd invented a whole universe, and he had, you know. He was a brilliant man.
It's the work that matters.
Really remembers if Star Wars, you know, I guess people know because it's so famous, but Star Wars didn't win the Oscar for Best Picture. I guess that's probably well known, but, you know, people remember it even though it didn't win the Oscar. So the awards are nice. It's very nice. I'm not giving my Oscar back or anything, but it's the work that matters. And it's the, you know, people remember. I wasn't even nominated for Empire Strikes Back, you know, but a lot of people have told me they think that's the best of all of them, you know, so... it's really the work that matters and not the awards.
George Romero.
So he was a lovely guy. He was a sort of a big bear of a man, very warm. He worked in Pittsburgh. He was really down to earth. He was not taking with the whole Hollywood thing at all. He had his way of working. He had his people around him, and he had, you know, this particular horror vision that tickled him, I suppose, you know, and Stephen King had written the script, and I got a chance to meet Stephen. He came to the editing room because Carrie was the first of his pictures, first of his novels ever to be made into a movie, and so we had a nice conversation. He quoted me in his book on writing, which was very flattering.
Lovely. We have a seems a similar film in reading your book that we're both a fan of, and that's Weird Science.
Yeah, I told John I liked the picture. He said to me, really?
Yeah. So in the context, like, he was surprised that you would like it, or that would appeal to you?
No, what happened with John is he got sick of the movies he was working on. He hated them by the time he got to the end.
Right.
So if somebody said they liked something, he would be surprised. Really? You thought it was good?
Right. What about Weird Science tickles you, or is it just the whole thing?
Well, I don't remember really. I think I'd been hired, and I was curious to see what he'd done, you know. There were things in it that made me laugh, I suppose. I don't really remember much about it.
A great deal. When I think of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I think of a scene that you talk about editing in your book, and that's the final scene where Steve Martin and John Candy part company, and you talk about changing that sequence where Steve Martin rides the train, and he's recalling all the things that John Candy told him about himself.
Right. What happened originally was that there was a scene in which Candy told Steve I mean, basically what happens is they part company on this platform in the city. Steve gets on a train out to the suburbs. He gets off the train. He goes into the suburban station, and he trips over Del's trunk once again. And he looks up, and there's Candy sitting there. And he says, Del, what are you doing here? He says, well, I got a lift from a truck driver. He gave me a lift. And he says, no, I mean, what are you doing here? Why don't you go home? He says, I can't. He says, what do you mean you can't go home? And he says, I have no home. And then he spills the whole story about Marie, his wife, died, and he has no place, and he travels around, you know, and... he attaches himself to strangers, and he really likes Steve, and, you know, and around the holidays, it's really tough on him. He likes to, you know, sometimes he goes to church. And while he's doing this speech, the audience started laughing, and it was not a good laugh. And the more pathetic the story was that Candy was telling, the harder they started to laugh.
Right, right.
So we thought, uh-oh, this is really not good.
Yeah.
So, you know, desperation produces inspiration, and we were operating against a very tight deadline at that point, and we came up with this idea of, instead of Del's, you know, explaining everything, we came up with this idea of having Steve put it together in his own mind through these flashbacks, and that whole sequence was completely constructed in the editing. It had not been written or anything.
Right.
And go back, once he makes the realization, he puts two and two together, we had him go back to fetch Candy. And now, we hadn't seen the interior of the station, so we took the interior of the train station for the suburbs, and we played that as if it was the train station in the city.
Right.
So we have a shot of the train returning to the station on the elevated platform in Chicago. We only had one shot of the train leaving, so we took that shot, we ran it backwards. So we had the train arrive.
Right, right.
Shot of Steve getting off, and he goes in, and all he says, and then, you know, Candy's sitting there, and he says, you know, let's go, and he invites him home. So, it was an elegant solution to a difficult problem.
One of my wife's favorite films that she insisted that I ask you about, and it's in your book, Steel Magnolias, and you talk about choosing between a film that tugs the heartstrings and a scene that makes you cry.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's, you know, this is what you face as an editor. You have to look at this material and make judgments about which scene makes me cry harder. So you have to sit there crying while you're watching the movie. So
right.
It was difficult. I had lost a friend that year, and it was emotionally very, very difficult.
Falling down?
Oh, yeah. Well, there had been an out-of-focus shot earlier in the film, in the shooting, rather, and I had pointed it out. And he had made life kind of difficult for me. So when they shot the final shot of the last shot in the production, came up out of focus, I pointed it out to Joel. Had gone off to shoot a television pilot, and was not at the screening of the dailies. And the DP, Andre Bartkowiak, was there, and the line producer, Dan Colesrud, and we all looked at it and said, well, it's out of focus. And I sort of assumed that the word would get to Joel, but it hadn't. And he hadn't been bothered by the out of focus shot that I'd pointed out previously, so I thought, well, maybe it just doesn't matter, you know.
Yeah.
So he gave me a hard time about that.
Editors care about film above everything else.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're all trying to make the best possible movie, and the collaborative nature of filmmaking often results in camps developing between, say, the producer and the director, or between the director and the studio, or between the director and the producer and the studio, or whatever. And it's not in the editor's power to achieve consensus between all these different parties, but you have to be guided by, I've always been guided by what I think is best for the movie, regardless of the politics of it. Now, that said, I think that it's your obligation to support the director, because that's who you've been working with and creating, you know, the cut. But it's a double obligation. You have an obligation to the director, and you have an obligation to the project. And you always have to keep your eye on trying to make the best possible movie.
A good place to end. Mr. Hirsch, I thank you for all your kindness and generosity. And, of course, I thank you very much for being on Podcasting Software.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you very much, sir.